Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined in our D.C. studio by Sarah Longwell, who is the publisher of the Bulwark, and Mona Charon, whose piece I want to get to in just a moment. Remember back in the 2016 campaign, it was actually relatively early, it was March 2016, Donald Trump announced something that he sort of suggested before. He was basically explicitly endorsing war crimes, right? It's a, you know, Bret Baier was moderating one of the debates and noted that about 100 foreign policy experts had signed a statement saying they weren't going to support Trump because he had threatened to order the military to target terrorist families and employ torture techniques that were worse than waterboarding. So he was asked, so if you were president of the United States and the military refused to carry out an illegal order, what would you do? And remember, this is what Donald Trump, candidate Donald Trump, said back then.
They won't refuse. They're not going to refuse me, believe me.
But they're illegal.
Let me just tell you, you look at the Middle East, they're chopping off heads. They're chopping off the heads of Christians and anybody else that happens to be in the way. They're drowning people in steel cages. And he now we're talking about waterboarding. This really started with Ted. A question was asked of Ted last two debates ago about waterboarding. And Ted was, you know, having a hard time with that question, to be totally honest with you. They then came to me. What do you think of waterboarding? I said, it's fine. And if we want to go stronger, I'd go stronger, too, because, frankly, that's the way I feel. Can you imagine these people, these animals over in the Middle East that chop off heads, sitting around talking and seeing that we're having a hard problem with waterboarding? We should go for waterboarding and we should go tougher than waterboarding.
But targeting terrorist families?
And I'm a leader. I'm a leader. I've always been a leader. I've never had any problem leading people. If I say do it, they're going to do it.
All right. So then Bret Baier actually followed up, asking about the targeting of the terrorist families. And it's worth listening to what Trump said. He goes into this little riff about the wives of the 9/11 hijackers.
That's what leadership is all about.
Even targeting terrorist families.
Well, look, you know, when a family flies into the World Trade Center, a man flies into the World Trade Center, and his family gets sent back to where they were going, and I think most of you know where they went, and by the way, it wasn't Iraq, but they went back to a certain territory. They knew what was happening. The wife knew exactly what was happening. They left 2 days earlier with respect to the World Trade Center, and they went back to where they went, and they watched their husband on television flying into the World Trade Center, flying into the Pentagon, and probably trying to fly into the White House, except we had some very, very brave souls on that third plane. All right?
Senator Cruz, you
have no problem with it.
Now, like a lot of what the president said, that was not true. Mona Charon, you wrote that of the 19 hijackers, none had a wife or girlfriend living in the United States. Only two were married. Only one had a girlfriend. But, you know, and eventually Trump walked it back. But now he is the president of the United States, the commander in chief. And in the last several weeks, he's taken rather dramatic steps, pardoning one convicted war criminal, tweeting praise of another Green Beret accused of murder as a U.S. military hero, and then moving another Navy SEAL who's been accused of war crimes from the break. And what really strikes me about all of this is that other than your piece, this did not receive a lot of attention. So I want to talk about this and what the president is doing and what he's really saying about the military. So first of all, let's talk about the two cases that you highlight. One's a full pardon. The other is a let's be nicer to this other Navy SEAL. Move him out of the detention facility that he was in.
And announce that this is part of looking over all of the convictions of Americans who have been brought up on charges of violating the laws of war. The president's going to take a close look at that with an eye toward possibly issuing more pardons. And the president has made it very clear that he thinks, in his worldview, that we have to be as bad as our enemies. That's the world we're living in, and if you don't agree with that, you're a chump.
And you remind us that he said these things during the campaign.
Yes,
remember, there was a period where he was saying that he was going to order members of the military to engage in torture and in war crimes. And people said, well, would they obey you? And yes, absolutely. I'm a leader. They'll do exactly what I say.
Yeah, exactly.
But of course, people thought that was just bluster.
Yes.
That's just what the president says. That's not what he's going to do.
Exactly. And the Republican Party basically said, you see, after, you know, after he took office, you see, we haven't descended to the standards of Westeros. The president is handling himself, and all is normal. Your panic about his promise to commit war crimes was overwrought. Well, we now see that in this instance. So let's talk about some of the details of the cases. All right. First of all, you could make a whole case that it's never right for a president of the United States to interfere with an ongoing matter, right? Because that's bigfooting it. Mm-hmm. It's not allowing the system of justice to unfold as it should. He, of course, is within his rights as president of the United States to pardon somebody. But if he chooses to do that, he should at least have the decency to wait until the judicial process has been fulfilled. He hasn't done that. Now, in the case of Gallagher, This was a Navy SEAL, and the stories about him are really amazing. And I say this, you know, what really drew my eye was I noticed that his fellow SEALs turned him in. And there is a culture in the military, and particularly among these elite forces like the SEALs and the Rangers, where it has to be something pretty horrible for your fellow combatants to turn on you and rat you out, as it were. But this guy was they were scared of him. He was known to have lost it in battle, where he was shooting at civilians on purpose. He was shooting at old men and little girls. One was about a 12-year-old girl in a flower print hijab, according to a SEAL testified to that. In another case, it is alleged that he there was a 15-year-old boy combatant, maybe ISIS or Taliban, who was already severely wounded and unconscious, and that he stabbed him and killed him, and then took a photo of the kill, texted it to his fellow SEALs, and held a reenlistment ceremony with the corpse. This is sick stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when you're killing little kids and old people, and as you wrote, Navy SEALs reported these, what they thought of as gross violations of the laws of armed conflict to superiors. They were warned that speaking out could damage their careers, and they did it anyway.
That's correct.
So this was so offensive that these other Navy SEALs... Now, Donald Trump just last month, or actually in March, tweeted out that he was moving Gallagher out of restrictive confinement in honor of his past service.
Yes. And that sends a very clear signal, especially when at the same time that he's pardoning Behenna, who is another member of the military who did something that did result in a court-martial. He was assigned... there was a roadside bomb that killed two men in his unit, very, obviously, traumatic for all concerned. But intel brought in a whole bunch of people who they thought might have had a link to this bombing. And it turned out that this one guy who they suspected of being a bomb maker, but they didn't have the evidence for it, he was told, take him back to his village.
They had released him.
Okay. Take him back to his village. He didn't take him back to his village. He took him to a culvert by the railroad. He stripped him naked, and he interrogated him further at gunpoint, saying, if you don't answer my questions, I'm going to kill you. And he did kill him. And then he buried him in a shallow grave. And then the next day, perhaps thinking better of this, he went and disinterred the body and burned it.
Mm.
So, again, you know, look, I'm not... This sounds bad. On the other hand, he did serve 5 years, so you can make a case for his pardon, perhaps. But it is part of a larger picture where the president has said over and over again that he thinks we need to be tough, we need to be vicious. He said, you know, in that famous debate that you referred to a minute ago, he said, they're cutting off heads. They're drowning people in cages. You know, we're too nice. We have to be just as bad, you know?
Well, he thinks he's upholding the honor of the U.S. military,
exactly,
though, right?
That's just what I was going to get to. So he thinks he's upholding the honor of the U.S. military. And that's why it's so important for those of us who disagree to speak up, and especially for the military members, too. Because in point of fact, one of the things that makes us so proud of our military is that the overwhelming majority do not commit war crimes. And you judge a country and a culture not by whether war crimes get committed. They always do. But by how the country responds to that and how the military responds. And we have had a tradition of punishing people who commit these crimes and of not treating it as just a cost of doing business.
Sir, I want you to react to this. The last paragraph of Mona's article is one of these chillingly familiar warnings. Now that he's commander-in-chief, taking concrete steps to undermine the values and traditions of our most important institution, you know, the president is, the question now is not whether the military will obey an illegal order, but whether the nation will abide this ethical corrosion and slide in the savage direction that Trump embraces. This is the, because what we've seen over and over again is the willingness to adjust standards and the way in which whatever Trump does, you know, leaving that aside, it's the corrosive effect that he has on the rest of the country. I mean, I think that is exactly the warning that Americans, you know, I think, you know, might feel the bloodlust and want to go, yeah, that's absolutely, burn their families and everything. But on more sober reflection, realize that's not who we are. We are a decent people. We do not kill women and children. And yet, if the president taps into that, if the president, you know, is the not appealing to our better angels, he has that effect on us, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, that's what's so chilling about Mona's piece, right, is that the answer to that question, almost implicit in the fact that this gets so little attention, is that maybe we are going to tolerate it. I mean, when we talk about supporting the troops, this is not what we've meant, right?
No.
And I wonder, I was sort of thinking about this as I read your piece, with Trump, you know, obviously one of his sort of defining characteristics is that he did not serve and that he had, you know, some absurd, you know, reason for not serving. And sometimes when he doesn't know anything, and there are a great many things he doesn't know much about, trade being another one, he tends to overcompensate in those
exactly
particular
right.
areas.
Point. Yeah.
And that's where you get these really dangerous moments where he's undermining the things that have elevated us as a country in the eyes of the rest of the world. And those are like, and to me, this is where it gets crazy, because those are the big things. Those are the things that we should be reacting to the most. And they are the ones that, like, nobody talks about.
It is the schoolyard bully who thinks that being a bully is a form of strength and courage. So he gets it wrong and distorts it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he goes after the weakest kid on the playground, not the strongest.
Right.
But, you know, there is always this tendency in any people. You know, if you go back and you study what was happening in the 1960s, My Lai happened in Vietnam. And there were certainly voices within the U.S. who said, well, you know, our guys can't really know who the enemy is. And, you know, it's so hard for them. And I don't blame him. And he shouldn't be made a scapegoat and so on.
There was a song.
That's right.
We remember this.
Was it a catchy song?
it actually was. I think I actually owned the 45 at one point.
But it's,
we had to do a deep dive and pull that out, you know.
Yeah, see if we can find it. But that, so those tendencies are always there, and it's the job of responsible leadership not to fan that kind of feeling, but to remind us of our better natures and to remind us that we do live up to high standards. And, you know, Bill Kristol was tweeting just today that, you know, he was talking to somebody who served in Afghanistan who was saying, you know, the overwhelming majority of our military upholds those high standards, and that's what we, you know, we admire about them, and we should. But you know, it's not that hard to undermine those standards.
No,
it's
civilization is very thin.
It's thin.
I mean, it is. I'm sorry, it's the cliche, but it is the Lord of the Flies type thing that you have to have centuries of civilization so that we do not eat the hearts of our enemies.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I mean, because we do have that beast within us type thing.
Right.
But this does not honor the military. That's the key point here. This is not pro-military to say basically that you're a chump if you do not act this way.
Now, I want to be pro those SEALs who did the right thing and turned this guy in.
Yeah, but unfortunately, you know, this whole thing did not spawn 1,000 think pieces. Now, Trump giving Pete Buttigieg a nickname of Alfred E. Newman spawned 1,000 think pieces and a day's news cycle. But this goes almost entirely unreported.
Because our press is almost as shallow as our president. They really are.
Well, you know, you mentioned an email that Bill sent out this morning, and he got this from an acquaintance who served in combat as a Marine officer in Afghanistan. That's what he wrote. He said, "I couldn't agree more with your piece, Mona. Though it is not just Trump, it's infuriating to see all these guys going out on a limb for a SEAL who was so out of control that his fellow SEALs turned on him, especially the vets like Waltz, Mast, Banks, who should know better about policing our own, and particularly Crenshaw, Congressman from Texas, who should understand better than anyone what it means for a SEAL to turn on one of his teammates. And what are they even complaining about? Gallagher, the guy that killed the old people and the kids, is being held in the brig. Well, he's an alleged war criminal who murdered women and children. That is exactly where he belongs. And again, this is from a Marine officer who had served in Afghanistan. This is not some elite guy from Georgetown. So, yes, this didn't receive nearly as much attention as it deserved. Okay, let's turn. I know you talked about
from war crimes to abortion. a happy podcast.
Well, you know, it's this is what America needed. We apparently were not divided enough. We were not polarized enough. We were not tribal enough. We had not pushed each other to the extremes enough. So let's have a debate about abortion. And we're talking about, obviously, the Georgia bill, the heartbeat bill, the very extensive bill in Alabama, which has been signed, Ohio, Missouri. And you really get the sense that, and I know you all know that using the term both sides brings out people from the woodwork, but both sides have really moved to the extremes on all of this. I talked with James Holman on the podcast yesterday about how the Democrats have now, they're not even clearing their throats about abortion. It's gone from being, it's a very difficult choice to being a positive good. But I know you talked about this on the secret podcast the other day, Sarah. I think that there is a legitimate distinction among pro-lifers, and there's a debate among pro-lifers, between the Georgia bill and the Alabama bill. Where do you come down on this?
Yeah, well, the Alabama bill, and so I learned actually a lot about this talking about it with JVL, and I would probably say of the four of you now that I'm having this abortion conversation with, I'm probably the most pro-choice, though if I am with any of my group of friends, I am absolutely the most pro-life. So this really depends on where you come down. But what's specific about the Alabama bill is that most of these other bills still make those exemptions, those sort of key exemptions for the health of the mother, life of the mother, rape, and incest. Okay, and that is that's become a very important tenet of sort of the moderation around abortion, and it gives people comfort that in these incredibly extreme, sad, difficult. I mean, even Eric Erickson had a piece today in The Resurgent, which I was sort of surprised to see, that says I'm okay with exemptions for rape. Because he was talking about the idea, this wasn't somebody making a choice in their life that they now have to sort of own and take ownership of. It is somebody who was forced to carry the wound of something. You know, like, so those exemptions are really key to having sort of a moderate bill. So that the Alabama bill does not make those exemptions. It makes the exemption for life of the mother, not health of the mother. And so it is the most extreme
and not
bill.
Not rape or incest.
And not
in Alabama, it does not make an exception for rape.
Oh, rape or incest. Yeah. Exactly. So it is the most extreme bill that anybody's seen. And this is, to me, so I'm going to just come at it right now from a political standpoint, where you really had Democrats on the run on the abortion issue. Like, Republicans have made tremendous strides in convincing the country that, number one, people are more pro-life than they've ever been. You know, even this new generation is... They may be great on gay marriage. They're all fine with gay marriage, but they are more pro-life than they've ever been. And so the pro-life movement's been making a lot of headway. And then the Democrats continue to do things like not just defend late-term abortion, but they have these sort of things like shout your abortion, or we're going to light up the Empire State Building when we pass an abortion bill, where it feels almost celebratory.
Was celebratory.
And it's sort of ghoulish, you know, if you start to actually think about abortion, not just as this tribal political issue, but like what it actually is. And so I think that this is an example of Republicans then just snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. No, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory the other way. Because now you have just reminded the country, every Republican is going to be asked, where are you on this Alabama bill? And Republicans are going to have to answer. And, you know, you remember Todd Akin. He just gave up that Senate seat by talking about legitimate rape. And now you're going to put Republicans in that position where they've got to defend this bill. And that's a bad political position.
And apparently so far, like the Martha McSally's of the world are basically saying, look, Alabama should be able to make its own decisions, that sort of thing. But I'm not sure that that's the formula to get out of this. Now, Mona, I, by the way, agree. The incrementalist strategy had, in fact, been working. But we are in an age of real impatience that we have to win. Now is the moment. We have this chance. We have Kavanaugh on the court. You know, swing for the fences. Go for it all. And that's how you got the Alabama bill. But the Alabama bill is, in fact, from a legal point of view, I think probably the weakest bill to have in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. But also, in terms of shifting the debate, which you're right, when the Democrats are talking about late term abortions, they're losing. When they're talking about an absolute ban on abortion with no exceptions for a woman's health, for rape or incest, that's a political disaster for the pro-life movement.
I think to summarize what you're both saying, that the side that is talking about the other side's extremism wins in these debates. So when the Democrats refuse, for example, to vote for the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Bill and say, oh, you don't need that. It's, you know, no worries. They look extreme.
That is extreme.
It is extreme.
Yeah.
Exactly. And when Republicans say no exceptions, not even for rape or incest, they look extreme. So I do agree as a prudential matter that this is probably not the best course for the pro-life movement to take, the Alabama bill. Let me say just another word about why rape, incest, and life of the mother or health of the mother, but that can get slippery because if you include mental health, it becomes a huge loophole. But I think one of the things that plays into the hands of the left when you deny, look, it is not the fault of the conceived baby how it was conceived. We all agree about that. And it's a tragic, horrible situation when it happens. And it does happen, rape and incest pregnancies. So it's not the child's fault. On the other hand, you have to be realistic and know that from the point of view of the 77% of the American people who believe in rape and incest exceptions to abortion laws, it looks to them like what you're doing there when you refuse to allow those exceptions is not that you are concerned about the baby, but that you're trying to punish women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really pushes people too far, and it seems cruel. And I understand how it can come across that way. I know that a lot of, you know, sincere pro-life people say, no, I really feel bad for the mother. I just think the baby's innocent. But I'm afraid that's not the message that comes through when you refuse to make those exceptions. Let me make one quick other point. Traditionally, other successful pro-life legislation has contained those exceptions, like the Hyde Amendment had an exception for rape and incest, life of the mother. So it's not as if we haven't included those before in things that we considered to be pro-life victories.
Well, that's when prudential considerations were taken more seriously. And I think the real irony about this, as you watch both sides become so maximalist, is there is a mushy consensus in this society, isn't there? There's a mushy consensus. The vast majority of people, even if you are pro-life, you don't want abortions after, say, 20 weeks, or at least you become very squeamish
about it. Even if you're pro-choice,
I'm sorry. If you're pro-choice and you acknowledge the moral complexity of the issue, you acknowledge the difficulty, you acknowledge that it may not be a choice you would make, and that there should be these kinds of exceptions. There are very few Americans who I think, in their heart of hearts, are absolutely, I'm against abortion under any circumstances. And there are very few Americans who really believe that you should be able to have an abortion for any reason right up until the moment of birth. And yet, here we are once again seeing those extremes driving the debate when the 70 or 80% of Americans who have these complicated views are just sort of sitting and banging, who's going to be crazier here?
Yeah, and it's sort of like the immigration debate or the gun debate so many of our debates these days where...
That is true.
Yeah, where they're actually... It's like people are like, oh, why can't we make any headway on this? Because you look at the polling and there'll be 70 or 80% of people agree on sort of common sense gun restrictions. You know, things like if you have a previous violent offense, you don't get a gun. You know, there's things that people support. But you know why? It is because there is a machine on both sides of this that has to churn out fundraising letters. I mean,
and
build money and churn people up. And come election time, they are there to pull us apart. And that what is just insane is how much agreement we actually have on so many issues and how incapable we are from a legislative standpoint finding that common ground.
But who's doing that with this abortion issue? Because the mainstream pro-life organizations were not behind the Alabama bill. Many of them appear to have the same reaction that we're having to this. When you have Pat Robertson and Ralph Reed and you said, you know, Eric Erickson out there, I mean, these guys are hardcore pro-lifers. When they are expressing concern that it's extremist, where does it come from? I mean, how does no one, you know, are we in an age where no one wants to say, I am pro-gun, I am pro-life, but I don't want to go this far. Nobody wants to have anybody get to their right or left?
But, you know, they maybe were looking at what happened in New York State.
Yeah. Okay.
And saying, oh, my God, those crazy, you know, people in New York State just passed a law saying, yeah, you can have an abortion right up until the moment the baby's head crowns, and that's fine. And
the left is not into incrementalism, are they, on this?
No, exactly. The left is not into incrementalism. They did swing for the fences. They got it all. And even then, it wasn't enough for them. And they went even further. So it has a radicalizing effect on the other side. And by the way, when I say this to some conservatives who are very, you know, pro-Trump, and I say, look, I mean, he is driving the left even crazier. They say, oh, no, no, no. The left was always really crazy. He hasn't had that effect. I think he has. I think that there is an equal and opposite reaction a lot of the time in politics. And when you push too far, it does create a backlash.
Well, this is disturbing, you know, to hear, you know, the Kirsten Gillibrands of the world. How do you pronounce it? Gillibrand? I think it's Gillibrand.
I think it's Beto.
I don't think that I'm going to have to learn that. I think that guys like, you know, de Blasio and Beto, I don't think I'm going to have to really worry about how to pronounce their names. But, you know, as a pro-lifer who wants to have a dialogue across these lines, I at least want to hear what James Holman calls the throat clearing. I at least want to hear an acknowledgement that this is a complicated, difficult issue. And when you go to this full-throated, absolutely, we're going to do this, then there is no conversation. You know, I for example, like you know, Mayor Pete, I think he and I would disagree fundamentally on this issue. But I at least think that I could imagine sitting in this room and having a reasonable, intelligent, and respectful discussion about it. And I'm not. And I think that's becoming more and more rare.
And one area, if I can just, you know, attempt this, where you could possibly find some across-the-board agreement is that we need to do more to make adoption a more common thing in America. There are something like 36 couples waiting for every baby that gets adopted. There are 36 couples waiting who would love to adopt. And it's so often presented as crisis pregnancy, the woman has only two options. She can abort or she can raise a child that she's not equipped to raise. And those are not the only two choices. And we never talk about that.
Actually, that's a perfect segue. But I was going to get to this, that with all the things that have gone, and I've been part of the pro-life movement for decades now. And, you know, one of the weakest parts, I think, I mean, one of the weakest talking points for the pro-life movement is, you're pro-life up until the moment of birth. What are you going to do? Now, we've seen this absolute collapse of fertility in this country.
That's true.
The absolute collapse in the number of people who are having babies. At the same time, of course, we've had a decline in abortions as well. So the question is, why are people not having babies anymore? And is there anything that the pro-life movement can do to say, all right, we would like you to choose life. What can we do to make that easier? I could imagine a program that says, all right, you know, let's not have late-term abortions, but let's have a major initiative that makes it clear that we are in favor of families, we're in favor of babies. What does it take to do that so that young women, you know, feel that it's not a financial burden? But that gets lost.
Yeah, in some ways, and Mona is going to be able to answer this way better than I am, but I would say at some point, you know, the culture of life conversation has become all about abortion.
Right.
Everything has been, you know, boiled down to its political elements in the way to, like, demonize the other side or own the other side or fight with the other side. And this is a culture war thing that, like, sometimes I feel, as somebody who's 39 years old, I am so sick of the baby boomers culture wars. Like, and the way that they talk about things, like, they are still stuck in the exact same frameworks that they've been stuck in for the last 40 years. And it's like, why can't we have a new conversation around adoption? I mean, there are, that is totally true. As somebody who's looked at adoption, you know, it is almost unreasonable to do it. It's so hard to get it done. There's so many people who want kids and can't have them. And so we don't have the culture of life can't just be about abortion. Right. It has to be about encouraging families, like you're talking about, in lots of structural ways. And I feel like the social conservative movement, of which I am not a part but have been around for a long time, at some point kind of got derailed by, like, fighting over gay marriage or some other things. And it sort of forgot to, like, fight for marriage and fight for some of the institutions and why they were great, instead of trying to either keep people out of them or push back.
I think you're exactly right. I remember I had a really...
Actually, I don't. So I'm going to disagree, but you go first.
No. I want to hear that.
I think in part that this allegation that the right or the pro-life movement only cared about the baby up until the moment of birth and not after is not quite fair. I've been to many crisis pregnancy centers around the country where they provide help, support, babysitting, diapers, all kinds of things throughout the first year of life for the babies that they've helped bring into the world. And that you get whole communities participating in these things. And I think it's unjust to say that they're only concerned about the baby until it's born and not after. And by the way, I'm actually, I was associated with an organization that does this for Jewish women who face crisis pregnancies. So there are a lot of efforts out there.
But not big enough.
Not big enough.
Yeah.
That's what I was talking about culturally.
Yeah, no, that is true. And let me just mention one other interesting datum that I came across when this topic of our birth dearth came out this week. And that is that if you look into the crosstabs, you find that actually, though the number of births to women is dropping fairly precipitously, women are not having as many children as they say they would like to have, which is very interesting. Something is holding them back. Part of it is there are fewer men who are marriageable these days.
Why is that?
If you read my book, it's in the chapter about the family, and part of it is because we have spent so many people in the last several decades have had to grow up in single-parent families. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that being raised by a single parent is much harder on boys than it is on girls. It's hard on both, but boys suffer more, and boys are more likely, if they've been raised by a single mother than their sisters are, to be unemployed, not to finish school, to get into trouble with the law, to have drug issues, and so forth. And when you consider that half of all children are growing up in disrupted homes, it leaves fewer marriageable men.
You know, this issue of the culture.
I thought it was video games, but okay, that's a better.
Well, yeah. Okay, I think it's video games. You know, guys that won't grow up, refuse to commit pornography. I'm willing to go the whole range here.
Yeah. All of the above.
You know, Sarah, your point about the culture wars, and I would make it more specific to Christianity and Christian values, that, you know, when you hear some of the leading Christian voices talk about these issues in the culture war, you would think that the only morality they care about is sexual morality. Mm-hmm. It's you know, who is doing what to whom, and it's like the entire moral philosophy centers around what people do with their dicks. I'm sorry, and it comes down to
and you don't think that them endorsing Donald Trump the way they did had anything to do with cementing that image in the public mind, right?
Exactly, exactly. Because and this is where I think that there needs to be some pushback on it. It's how about your honesty, your decency, your compassion, your honor, all of those things that have gotten lost. And I do think that this obsession of despite what you said, Mona, about all of the programs, and which are wonderful programs, I don't think right now when people look at the pro-life movement, they see the compassion and the love for families before they see the, look what you're trying to do, you're trying to restrict. Now, again, that is unfair, but it's a reality. And I think what's going to happen with this Alabama bill is it's going to take that perception. It's really going to ratchet it up.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, because you have to have moral credibility, which is something that no longer anybody has. You know, people don't strive for it the way that they used to. Moral consistency. You have to consider sort of both sides. So like for right now, the abortion debate too often feels like, I think you mentioned this, Mona, a policing of women's bodies, as opposed to, we do not have a particularly large conversation around the obligations of men, around the honor and integrity of what it means to be an honorable and decent man. I mean, you know, we are, now I'm not saying it doesn't start with broken homes, but like culturally, we no longer are having a conversation about what it means to be decent fundamentally. And a lot of that corrosive or that just sort of lack of conversation is what led an entire generation of evangelicals to apparently endorse Donald Trump. Because this is in my head because you talked about it, but Bill Bennett, who I also in the late 90s, right, when I'm a teenager coming of age, I listened to a lot of Bill Bennett stuff about the Book of Virtues. And he's like, nobody even talks like that anymore. Certainly nobody on the right. And here's my question. My question, especially, well, both of you guys are sort of social conservatives. When will the right be able to have those conversations again? Will it ever be able to? Because I grew up in a conservative movement. I came up in that world, and it was baked in to the bigness of the conversation around conservatism. And I just think after Donald Trump, it can't exist.
Oh, you underestimate the powers of hypocrisy.
And denial. No, but I do think that eventually the piper will be paid, and that people don't realize it now, but they are, by so thoroughly morally discrediting the right, they are paving the way for a golden era of left-wing activism in this country, because the right will have no credibility on the issues that Americans care deeply about. And they want to know that you're well-motivated and that you're decent, even if you happen to disagree. But if you're not well-motivated and you're cynical, oh, boy.
You know, it does occur to me, we've had these ongoing culture wars. And, you know who won the culture war? What won the culture war was moral relativism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know that you get the sense, I mean, I really get the sense that whatever the position is on any of these issues, depending on whose ox is being gored, everybody will flip positions. Yeah. Everybody will take, and that there is no core anymore. And this, I must believe what my party, what benefits my party, has become so ingrained in all of this. And I think it's going to be, you know, the embrace of that kind of moral relativism by the conservatives is a disaster, because they were the last redoubt.
Yes.
They were the last bulwark, to use a term.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, yes. That's true on the cultural stuff, but it's also true on just the straight policy stuff. Like, I spent the last 8 years banging on a ton about the national debt. That was like a massive issue.
Yep.
And every conservative that I talked to cared about this deeply, fundamentally. This is about who we are. And I will tell you, I can't raise a conservative these days to take it on for the life of me.
Mm-hmm.
If I hear one more conservative say they just, that's probably good. I mean, Mick Mulvaney, it like causes my head to explode. This is a guy who got elected over the debt. The entire Tea Party movement was about the debt. So there's this entire Freedom Caucus in there that are just like following Donald Trump over this fiscal cliff.
Well, and limited government and free trade.
Yeah.
And whether character matters, and just keep running down that list.
Mm-hmm.
50 years of a conservative movement, a generation of or generations of people raised in it, all washed away. I think about the moral credibility question a lot, because I feel like I've got a long time of fighting, pushing back on some of the excesses of the left, and I don't know how you do it anymore with there's no movement there from a consistency or credibility standpoint, can push back.
I think the only thing that will get the conservative movement, to the extent there is anything like that, back together again is when they shift back to being reactionary against a left which is overreaching, which of course it will inevitably.
Well, yeah.
And that will be a comfortable position for people to say, well, we have no idea what we're in fact for, but we're definitely against that. And I think that's kind of the sweet spot.
Maybe.
No.
Yeah, I don't go for that anymore. I watched the Democrats in 2018 nominate at least 40 people who picked up House seats who were totally normal,
right,
moderate Democrats who I bet probably care a little bit about the debt. And, you know, they were, and they fought in the military. Unlike the president, many of them were women who are, you know, CIA analysts and really. So I think that we can continue to paint the left, and we certainly will try to be made entirely up of AOCs and Ilhan Omars and Rashida Tlaibs. But the fact is, I think the majority of that House caucus now looks a lot more reasonable than ours.
Well, it does, but although you never hear from them.
Yeah.
You never hear from them. You would think that there's only three freshman members of the House caucus.
Abigail Spanberger, let's hear from you.
No, that's absolutely right. We never hear anything from them, though I will say I suspect that you guys would agree with me that I've found myself saying over the past year, much to my own amazement, well, Nancy Pelosi, really?
I have strange new respect.
Yeah. on the other hand, let's be honest about it. And I agree with you, and I've said exactly the same thing. But the Democrats are losing this messaging war with Trump over the Mueller investigation.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what the right answer was, but I think that they thought that they could decide how far they wanted to push this. And now what they're finding out is that, well, Trump had a plan of his own, which is going to be that he's going to go on the offensive. He's going to create his own narrative. He's going to completely stonewall. And they right now really don't seem to know what to do about it.
That's right.
And I'm always a little shocked to find out how bad the Democrats are at politics.
Yeah.
Because I've been focusing on how bad Republicans can be. But they're really bad at this.
They are, although I will say the genius of the Trump method, and I have learned, I've learned this lesson. I've really internalized it, and I think a lot of other people have too, is that one scandal should never have one scandal. One scandal, a Benghazi scandal, you can have endless hearings about.
That'll
and dig
you.
Into every yeah, little right. thing. But if you've got 1,000 scandals, if they are so massive, if that report is 400 pages, here's what Trump always knew. No one was going to read a 400-page report. Because I'll tell you what, if you read it, you put it down and go, impeach that guy.
Yeah.
This is awful. But no one's going to read it. And they just they know that if they just throw so much stuff at you, that there's too much for the press to digest. There's too much for the public to digest. People get exhausted and they want to move on.
I think that's exactly. And that goes back to what we talked about earlier. Mona, your piece about the pardon of these and the love being given to these war criminals.
Yeah.
That in Earth 2.0, that would be a big deal. We would have a debate about all of that.
That's right.
And yet, in the world we live in right now, it just got it got passed. I mean, Conrad Black was just was just pardoned. I mean, Conrad Black, who is just a sleazy character, who has been writing one sucky piece, you know, sucking up to Trump. He, you know, it's basically he's, you know, Dinesh D'Souza cleaned up a little bit, and the sort of the arrogance and the cynicism, I guess, the cynicism of Trump's misuse of the pardon power. But again, we're like, okay, we were shocked by Sheriff Arpaio, but we're done.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
We can't keep doing it.
We can't keep up, and he knows it. And if, you know, I'm always a little skeptical of people who claim that Trump is some sort of political genius. I don't think he is. I do think he's a good manipulator of other people, though. And one way that he manipulates is by knowing that if he can just get his message out to enough of his followers, you know, and the message, which we saw happening in real time, that it was, you know, some of us were saying before the Mueller investigation concluded, that even if Mueller produced a videotape of Trump with Putin saying, yeah, you know, maybe we can help each other, Trump would say, no story, nothing to see here. And his followers would say, you're right.
I have a throwaway line here, because I was actually thinking of, and I'm really going to go out of my way not to mention the name of the person. But, you know, say one of the pundits, somebody who does roughly what we do, and watching them have a meltdown, not the person that I actually wrote about having a meltdown earlier this week. This was being confronted with hostile questions. And what occurs to me is we have this new dynamic where it used to be that if you went out and debated someone, you would try to persuade them, because otherwise you would then be criticized for the failure of your argument. But now in the new rules, you know, you have 12 million Twitter followers, you have your own universe, and it doesn't matter how you do. You can walk off the set. You can spit. You can be absolutely incoherent. And all you need to do is go and basically have your supporters say, you just killed it. You were just wonderful. You were
destroyed.
You are your own critic. You are your own cheerleader.
Yep.
And therefore, it changes the rules completely. You no longer need to perform at a high level. You no longer need to be honest. You can. And so it's not just Trump.
That's true.
It's almost everyone. No matter how badly you behave, there's going to be a universe that says you are just absolutely fantastic and your enemies just suck.
Not in absolutely every case. I mean, we have seen some flameouts. You know, we saw Milo go down.
Milo, yeah.
You know, I mean, there have been a few who've flown too close to the sun, but
right. There have been some, but he was never big enough to be able to pull it off. He thought that he was, but he wasn't.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are others.
Also, he went down for like endorsing molestation. Like, I mean, it was his stuff was crazy. Yeah. Like, I mean,
Trump could get away with that.
Yeah. Well, Roy Moore almost did.
Speaking of Roy Moore, we got to throw this in. So we're sitting here talking about this Alabama abortion bill given to us by the Alabama Republican Party. Last time we ever talked about the Alabama Republican Party, they gave us Roy Moore.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Hey. Thank you, Mona Charon. Sarah Longwell, appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Great to be here.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes.